The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 20% off during the month of September.
Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up.
So the big difference between me and you wouldn't be our hair colour, right? Genes that control our hair colour, eye colour or skin colour or anything else. It will be these immune system genes, the compatibility genes.
Daniel Davis gives us an insight into how your immune system could be determining who you get on with when you're out on a date. In fact, far from just fighting infections, your immune system has all sorts of influences on your behaviour. We'll also hear about the potential of genetic modification in the preservation of endangered species. And why rolling up into a ball is a more important evolutionary trick than you ever thought possible. All that, and the latest from the Curiosity rover on Mars. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We'll begin, as always, with the discussion of this week's news. And with me is The Guardian's Ian Sample. Hello, Guardian's Ian Sample.
Hello, Guardian's Alok Jha.
Hello. And we've also got Professor Kate Jones from University College London. Hello, Kate. Welcome back.
Hi.
Wonderful to see you here. We're going to start with you and your story this week. You're a conservation biologist, so we thought we'd get you talking about conservation. There's an interesting comment piece in Nature this week about strategies for conservation into the future. So, you know, in environment terms, we always talk about making habitats better and making sure that little animals are looked after, blah, blah, blah. But this was much more technological. Take us through this.
It's basically the idea that maybe we could use genetic modification, genetic engineering to GMO organisms. So GMO kind of endangered species to make them less endangered or more able to cope with our impact on their environment. So the impacts of climate change or habitat degradation or diseases that have been introduced, could we tweak the actual genomes of these species? And so, you know, there might be several ways of doing that. And this article explores that you could do hybridization between populations which are quite well adapted in other situations of the same species. And actually that's happening to some extent in different parts of the world anyway. And then maybe moving on from that to more specific genetic engineering. So not just the species, the populations hybridizing, but actually looking at the alleles or the genes in those populations which are doing well and inserting those into these populations. And then even more controversially, kind of inserting genes from other species into these populations so that they can adapt to them. And I did like the piece. I think it was a very thought-provoking piece, but it is actually happening to some extent in other places. And I think some conservationists have kind of been thinking about this for a while.
Is the last of those ideas, the idea you take, I don't know, a gene from something that's adapted to warmer weather and put it into an animal that might sort of not be able to survive so much as the climate changes, and then the animal you put it into becomes a creature that can survive, say, warmer weather. Is that just a mad idea? Would you have to do this in large scale? I mean, as a conservation biologist, do you just think, you know what, off you go, molecular biologist, this is a nice idea for you to talk about? Or do you really think this might be happening one day?
I think I can give you an example of where it is happening. And I think it is difficult to see it at this stage going large scale. And so maybe we're making a big fuss about this for absolutely nothing. And it actually can't happen at the scales which we think it can happen. So the example I'm thinking of is the American chestnut. So there's been a huge program over the last few decades, actually. And initially, they started off by hybridizing with the Asian chestnut so that they were getting that disease for resistance from the Asian chestnut. But if you think about it, when you cross an Asian chestnut tree with an American chestnut tree, you're hybridizing their entire genomes. So you're polluting their genomes with all of this other stuff, which actually might have, you know, negative effects on the American chestnut. So they took this other approach by looking at those genes and making a series of genes that they thought were resistant so that the pathogen couldn't just evolve and then you know, then the American chestnut would still be vulnerable. But they had a whole series of genes that they screened, and then they put those into the American chestnut. And now you can buy them online and, you know, grow them in your back garden.
Well, the GM versions?
The GM versions.
You can grow some GM.
Yeah, well, this is America, so you can
do that.
You can do that.
Ian, this technology that we were talking about, the idea of taking genes from one species and putting them into another, or even less controversially, taking them from the same species and inserting them into a different sort of subspecies. I mean, they're very common molecular biology techniques now. We use them in animal research all the time, and this is how a lot of genetic research happens. It's not that crazy a technology, but do you think that conservation's a step too far for this?
It's not a crazy idea to think about, and I really like the comment piece in Nature. But when you look at the practicalities of the most extreme things they're talking about, that becomes really... I think fiendishly difficult, because if you're talking about there is a bunch of animals in one part of the world which happen to be faring badly, and you then say, well, there's a population of this other species which seems to maybe struggle with, maybe cope with, you know, some other conditions, and maybe we can, what you're then going to say is you're going to identify what you think is the biggest environmental problem that the struggling population is struggling to deal with. You're then going to isolate the genes that help the successful population cope with it. So you're hoping that it's one, you know, issue that they've got to deal with, that there's a small number of genes that will help help them, and that they will work in the same way when you put them into the other animal. And
that's like a big ask, doesn't it?
It's a huge ask, and I don't think there are going to be many cases where you're going to say, okay, it's actually the fact that they can't see red very well, so they're not very good at finding berries or something, so we'll just find a thing for red photoreceptors and stick it. I don't think it's going to be a very simple process at all. I think it's going to be enormously complicated. And you know, the other idea that they're talking about, where you're taking you're trying to hybridize, you're trying to cross a successful population with an unsuccessful population of the same species. I know it's going to take a lot longer because you have to wait for breeding and natural selection to take place, but at least then you're going to have genes dumped into the right place, doing the right thing by definition, because the ones that survive will be more adapted.
So these technological solutions are all very well, but what about more standard ways of trying to reintroduce populations into the wild?
Yeah, I think that's really important as well. And we've just got a report from Zoological Society of London, amongst many other people, many other organisations that have looked at the state of European wildlife and to see whether there are some species which are coming back. Because you get this, you know, load of bad news all the time about how things are declining, and things are bad. But there are some good news stories. And I think this report that came out last week, it's kind of saying, you know, there are some populations which are doing actually really well.
What kinds of animals?
Like brown bear is obviously doing really well, especially in the Caucasus, are doing very well.
And I'm assuming that if people go to the ZSL website, they can download that report and read to their heart's content.
Yeah, you there's a big report.
The Zoological Society of London's website. Just Google it. Or go to our website, theguardian.com/environment, where I believe there will be a blog post about this. Ian, let's move on to the one you've brought for us, which is you're talking about a fossil that can curl into a ball. Why is that interesting?
What I liked about this was it's the first known example of an animal curling up into a ball to protect itself. So, and it happened more than 500 million years ago. And I just love the idea of this tiny thing curling up, putting its head between its tails and going, I'm just going to do this and hope that passes. 500 million years ago, that quite appealed to my senses. And it was found by accident. It was a guy was going through a collection of early Cambrian fossils from Canada, and he saw this. It was a kind of primitive form of trilobite, you know, these sort of little creatures that you see all the time for sale in fossil shops. And they're around for like 270 million years. And one of the reasons they fared so well was that they had this, they were the pioneers of the curl up in a ball protective move. And this is the oldest example of it happening. And it was funny, it was a bit rubbish at doing it. They found more than one example, but it couldn't quite do it properly. It couldn't achieve enough rolling up to achieve what
it's
they call encapsulation. When it got its head to its tail, so it protected it. The thing about trilobites, they have this hard calcified carapace on top. So they're trundling along the ocean floor. They're quite protected from above, but their legs are all soft and squishy, and so they're vulnerable from underneath. So you try and curl up if something comes along that's going to eat you, like this creature called Anomalocaris, which is like a vicious shrimp. Now, this trilobite didn't quite manage it. The later trilobites got really good at this stuff. They developed locking mechanisms and all sorts of things. So once they're curled up into a ball, they'd have a sort of a latch, and they would stay curled up in the ball without having to use their muscles to do it. And so you'd even find them in the fossil record curled up in a ball, because when they died, their muscles relaxed, but they stayed in that shape. And, you know, this is one of the most successful defensive strategies that you can have that's evolved. You know, you've got running away and you've got curling up in a ball as the two top things that a lot of animals do. And it evolved multiple times. You know, you see it in woodlice, you see it in armadillos, hedgehogs, pangolins, you know, all sorts of things.
And you spoke to the great Richard Forty about this. Was he as excited as you?
He's always excited.
He was obviously fantastic. And I make a point of not being starstruck when I talk to people that I am actually starstruck to speak to.
So that includes me and Alan.
Yeah,
as well.
Everyone. And I just try and think, look, I'm just talking to a scientist here. But it's Richard Forty. And
who is just explain who Richard Forty is for those who don't know.
He's a very important scientist.
who works at the Natural History Museum.
Yeah, he's a bit of a legend in the...
He's Mr. Trilobite.
Mr. Trilobite.
He is, but he is an absolute legend. And, you know,
fantastic
he's done
writer.
Some fantastic books and all the rest of it. But he was excited about this. And he was saying that what this paper showed was not only did trilobites pioneer this, but they learned it so early on. They experimented and they got this idea very early on. Their body morphology changed throughout the hundreds of millions of years, the tens of millions of years they were around to perfect it. And, you know, to be fair, if you're pretty small and you've already worked out you can run away, curling up in a ball is a cool thing to be able to do. And then they got spikes as well, and that makes it even better. All of these things make you, like, less
spikes
appealing.
On the outside?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they're like little sort of
So you end
grenades.
Up looking like a pufferfish, so nothing wants to eat you particularly.
Blimey. But you know, people do eat pufferfish.
You know, in the Cambrian, there was this enormous... arms race going on, and there were creatures there that were working out how to kind of untwist these things so that they could get at them. And so this, you know, then they developed the locks to say, well, you can't come in. And then there'd be other things that come along and just say, well, I'm going to have you anyway.
Kate's very excited about the phylogeny. So tell us what phylogeny is, first of all, and then why are you excited about it?
So phylogeny is a picture, basically, of the evolutionary relationships of these trilobites. And it's in the paper. And it shows like a small branch with a few species on it. For the ones which can curl up really not
Does this
very
thing
well.
Have a name, by the way?
Mamaspis, of course.
Mamaspis. And Kate, carry on. So Mamaspis is on this not very diverse bit.
Yeah, because it couldn't do it very well. And then the trilobites got a bit better at doing this, and they kind of branched off there, and there are a few species. And then they got really good at this, and then there was a huge explosion. So you can see that on the tree. It's very exciting.
And so the ones with the huge explosion obviously got better at actually becoming safer, so they survived.
Well, one interesting thing about this is that we're talking about a creature that has been curled up in a ball, and we found it entombed in rock. So it clearly didn't work this time round, okay? And also, it wasn't one of these trilobites that had a latch. So how is it still curled up? Because the reason they think we haven't found these sorts of things before, or don't find them very often, is because when it dies, if it doesn't have this lock, the muscles relax and it just flattens out again. So it looks like any other trilobite you find in a shop in Cornwall. And so what they think happened to this one is it was killed and kept in its position by a really huge, fast mudslide, which just slammed on top of it, and it was dead and encased before it had a time that you know, when the muscles relaxed and after it had died, it stayed in position.
Yeah, excellent. We've done global conservation. We've done fossils. Now let's go to Mars. Let's go to Mars. This week...
Where do you learn to do links like that?
I just make them up. Last week, five papers were published in Science magazine. These are the first set of peer-reviewed results coming from the Curiosity rover, which we've talked about many a time, and I'm sure both everyone has heard about and is excited about this wonderful machine that's trundling across the surface of Mars right now, very slowly. It's been there for just over a year, but these first five papers are about the first 100 days of the rover. And it's not really even doing many science experiments. It's really testing out all its equipment. But it happens to have got some interesting science results on the way to its main goal, which is to climb up Mount Sharp, which will happen later this year or early next year. And some of the things it's doing, the most interesting, I think, is this oven it's got on board. It's a tiny little oven that can go up to 835 degrees, and it scooped up some of the dust under its wheels, put it in this oven in very small amounts, like milligrams of this stuff, and just heated it up to 835 degrees to see what happened, to see what came off it. And they found all sorts of gases came off, including water and carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide, oxygen, etc. They found a few simple organic compounds, and all these things have been kind of reported before in conferences and stuff, but this is the multiple analyses published as a peer-reviewed paper, so it's now the science is official, if you like. And the most interesting result from the water analysis was that if you took a cubic foot of Martian dust underneath the wheels, so right at the surface, and boiled it, heated it up, you get about 2 pints of water. So there's a lot of water on Mars, which is good if you want to send people there. So some of the one of the authors of that paper in particular was saying this is kind of the stuff you need to know if you're going to send missions out there. You need to know exactly what chemicals are there. There's another series of experiments on different in different areas where they look at really quite hardcore geology of the crystalline structure of the rocks, things you've never been able to do off the Earth before. They've been able to look at bulk properties from space before. They've been able to say, for example, there's this mineral over here, or there's this element over there. But they haven't been able to look at the actual morphology of that stuff or the crystalline structure, which tells you how this stuff's formed, whether it's been weathered, all those sorts of things. So there's quite a lot of interesting stuff there. But the water's quite, I think, the most interesting bit of the whole thing. And it's now on its way to Mount Sharp. So then it does the real science. This is just stretching its legs, essentially. And it's not, as we all know, it's not meant to find signs of life. But I mentioned how it found some organic compounds in its oven as well. They don't know whether they know for a fact that these aren't Martian, because they don't seem to match with anything else around. But it doesn't mean that there are organic compounds in the soil. It could be that the stuff in the soil is reacting with the stuff already in the oven, or the oven itself, in fact. So they don't know that for a fact. And one final thing to say about potential missions to Mars. The fact there's water, great. But also there's a lot of this chemical called perchlorate in the dust, which is very bad for you if you breathe it in. It stops your thyroid from working. So we need to think about that too. Ian, Curiosity, you love it.
I do, and I wanted to ask you about Mount Sharp and the mission there. What I love about Mount Sharp is that it's 5 kilometres high, I believe, or 5 miles high, 5 kilometres high, I believe, in the middle of this Gale crater. And at the bottom, you're looking at rocks that are about 3.5-4 billion years old. And then as you go further up to the top of the mountain, you come up to more present-day geology. And so as you wind your route up, and what I absolutely love as a geek is that they used a lot of different overhead orbiting satellites to map the path that it will go up. And it will trundle up the mountain and it will take geological samples as it goes. And so it will be able to piece together geological history of the entire planet almost, or certainly the last three or four billion years. And that's lovely. But I don't know when it gets to the very bottom and can actually start that journey and how long that journey is going to take.
I don't know when it's going to get there. I think that it's moving very slowly. And it's not very, very far. It just can't go very fast. They don't want to break it. I think that would be a real disaster. I think what's interesting about Mount Sharp is it's stratified, isn't it? So there's layers and layers of history in there, which is why they landed at the Gale Crater, which is why they landed Curiosity there. And the bit that they've landed at is not meant to be very interesting. All of this data that's come back, already fascinating. It turns out it's not meant to be the interesting bit. There's reams of amazing stuff still to come. There's another interesting part to the whole reporting of all this, which is that a lot of the information in these papers, the headline stuff, is presented at conferences as scientific results are. But a lot of it is also just put online, pictures especially. And although it takes the Curiosity rover takes a panorama picture around itself every single day. And NASA has published one or two of these, which are beautiful, get into newspapers. But many members of the public and big groups of citizen scientists, essentially, are stitching these things together, creating movies every single day. I mean, this is data at an unprecedented level coming from, in unprecedented detail coming from another world. And I spoke to one of the scientists, one of the British scientists at Imperial College London, who's involved in plotting the route that Curiosity is taking. He's a geologist. And one of the things he said was that unlike Earth geology, where you kind of people have already mapped everything and you don't find anything that new, every single data point is brand new information as far as scientists are concerned here, because you just don't know what that rock in front of you is going to be made of. I mean, they stretched out their robotic arm and touched a rock, which they called Jake_M, named after a NASA scientist. And they thought it was just going to be, they were going to test out some equipment on the end of this thing. Turns out it's a volcanic rock that was chucked out by some volcano however many miles away. And it looks nothing like any of the rocks they expected or that are around there. I mean, they can tell this stuff now. There are high resolution pictures of it in the paper.
And I like the fact that it's almost open source, all of this data, and that they've got people, you know, that it's instant. You know, you look at it, you publish it. And in biology, it's not like that, you know, not yet anyway. And we're very protective of data and it takes us ages to publish anything. I think it's brilliant.
In conservation, though, there is a lot of citizen science stuff happening, isn't there, in terms of monitoring populations.
Yeah, and absolutely. Yeah.
They're very useful data, aren't they, those things?
Absolutely, yeah. It's just that they've got a physics and those kinds of areas, and astronomy have got a more open view of how to publish, and they're not afraid to put stuff out there to be verified before it's accepted in a peer-reviewed journal. And I think that's really quite. Yeah,
but there's still, it does appear in a peer-reviewed journal.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, I wasn't,
So that does happen. All right. Well, we'll leave all of that stuff there. If you want any more information on any of these stories, you can go to theguardian.com/science. And of course, if you want to know more about the Curiosity rover or download the oodles and reams of pictures there, you can go to nasa.gov. How often do you think about your immune system? Maybe only when you're unwell, when you hope it swings into action to fight off those viruses and bacteria. But your immune system does so much more than just that. Daniel Davis is Director of Research at the University of Manchester's Collaborative Centre for Inflammation Research. He's the author of a new book called The Compatibility Gene, in which he explores the genetic complexity of the immune system. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. You're here to talk about the immune system. And, you know, for me, the immune system, and for many listeners, I suppose, the immune system is something that's just there as a way of fighting off viruses and bacteria and things on the outside. But it does owe so much more than that, doesn't it? I mean, that's the message
right,
of this
so
book
that,
of
yeah,
yours,
thanks
it?
A lot. That's really great to be here. So that's a really important message. And one of the really big reasons why I wanted to write a book was the wonder of this genetic system that runs through all of humanity that is really, in one way, it's about the immune system, but it turns out that these same genes that are crucial to how our immune system works are also important in many, many other aspects of human biology. And in a sense, it gives us a glimpse of this overarching system that runs across all of people.
Yeah. I mean, when did we start to get a handle, first of all, on what the immune system is? We probably knew about blood transfusions a long time ago, that certain people can only have certain types of blood transfusion. But that's like noddy stuff compared to what the immune system does on a daily basis. And when did we start to get a handle on some of that stuff?
Okay. So actually, different scientists would have a different starting point at where and knowledge about the immune system began. So you could go right back to early vaccination, but we had little understanding of how that worked at the time. So in my version of the story, I begin around 60 years ago through the research of a scientist, Peter Medwar, who worked in Oxford. And through his pioneering research, along with his colleagues, they began to realize that the immune system is all about detecting what's part of you and distinguishing that from what's not part of you. And together with a theoretician, McFarlane Burnet in Australia, they coined the term sort of self-non-self discrimination to describe how your immune system works.
Before you go on, why is it important that we know those things? What could non-self things do to you?
So they got to that point through thinking about transplantation and why that didn't work. So from their perspective, the importance of all this was due to the Second World War, actually. So they were driven by the problem of people needing, for example, skin grafts after horrific burns during the Second World War, and they were concerned themselves about how to solve this problem of transplantation. Why is it that all human skin is not just basically the same? Why is it that I can't take a piece of your skin and put it, graft it onto me, and it would be fine? So thinking about that problem deeply led them to come up with this concept that your body is able to distinguish your own cells from the cells of other people, this recognition of self versus non-self. And that then led them through a whole series of many experiments with lots of people involved, led them to broaden that concept, to consider non-self as also being about germs.
Yeah, and so you get this idea of self and non-self, and the idea that there are sort of molecules and organelles and things, all sorts of things inside you that are there as sentry guards. Tell me what the sort of current picture of the immune system is. What parts are there, and how do we recognize it in our genomes?
Okay, so the immune system obviously has many different ways of detecting disease. One way is that it could recognize something that is obviously not part of you, like a sugar that's only found on a certain kind of bacteria or something like that. Clearly, that's trouble and it should deal with that. But it also has another aspect to it, which is that it could recognize something that has never been in your body before. And as long as that's in the context of some kind of danger or trouble, perhaps cells have been killed, then it realizes that that is a something that's non-self that should be attacked, that there's some kind of problem there. But really, actually, quite a deep understanding of that is still at the frontier of our knowledge. Because, for example, there's lots of things that go in you as non-self, like food, right? And your immune system shouldn't react to that. So actually, a very deep understanding of how your body is able to distinguish what's part of you and what's not part of you in the context of what might be dangerous is still vague in some of the details.
Well, we can go into the sort of edges of that research maybe a bit later, but in terms of what we do understand, I mean, the immune system, is it first of all one system, one sort of thing with a master control switch somewhere that keeps a record of what's been in the body and what hasn't been in the body and recognizes things? Because I mean, one of the things I wonder is how on earth do molecules and antibodies and whatever else, white blood cells going around your body, recognize that a sugar is foreign? Right. I mean, there are almost infinite numbers of these things.
Okay, so that's really important. So what happens is that your immune cells are capable, that when they're made, they're capable of responding to any type of molecule. Each immune cell gets checked out for if it could react to something that's made by your own body. And if it can react to something made by your own body, it gets killed off. So then the immune cells that are now allowed out to circulate around your body through your blood, for example, then those ones are now not able to react to something that's in your body and are poised to react to something that has never been in your body before.
So they're tested before they get out the gate.
So they're tested before they get out the gate as to whether or not they would react.
And where does all that happen?
So it happens in the thymus, for example. It also can happen in other places around the body during development. And again, some of that is still not entirely understood because, for example, during pregnancy, for example, your body might make protein molecules that have never been in your body before, and your immune system has to not react to those. So there are other ways in which the immune system could be switched off later in life. But again, the details of our understanding of that are not entirely clear. And in fact, that's one of the really exciting things about the immune system. So, you know, when you read a textbook and it's full of these ideas and complicated names of molecules, it feels like it's all done and dusted. But it doesn't take much to scratch beneath the surface and think of scenarios where actually we don't quite understand exactly what's going on. And that's another aspect of the sort of wonder of this area of science. You know, it's very easy to capture the same wonder in things like astronomy and black holes and space, where, again, the frontier is very accessible. But actually, the frontier of understanding how the immune system works is also very accessible. There are many questions you could ask, like the ones you're asking, and we don't actually understand in detail precisely how that works.
And one of the, it's great to have these molecules sort of flying around the body and being essentially loaded weapons against anything that isn't you. But isn't that also a bit dangerous? I mean, with the list of autoimmune diseases, when these molecules recognize bits of you and think they're not you, start to do things to you, everything from arthritis to all sorts of other things, which I can't think of now. You'll tell me. But these are your body attacking itself.
Right. So there are many, many autoimmune diseases, multiple sclerosis and diabetes, for example. So those are situations where your immune system has reacted as something that is part of you thinking it shouldn't be there. It's thinking it shouldn't be in your body for. And again, it's not entirely clear how many of those types of diseases begin. For what one, there are obviously many ideas, and one idea might be that a germ, let's say a virus, has a particular component that is very similar to one of your own. And so the immune system reacts to the virus version of that molecule. But then, because it's now got activated, it now starts to respond to the similar component that's normally part of your body. So that might then trigger an autoimmune reaction. But again, most of those autoimmune diseases are precisely how they begin inside a person. It's very hard to understand. Most of the time we look at what happens during those autoimmune diseases after they've started, once somebody turns up with symptoms.
And then messing around with the immune system to try and cure them is going to be a tricky task, because you don't want to affect the rest of what the immune system is meant to be doing.
Right. It's true that it's not, it's certainly not trivial to interfere with the immune system to get it to, but there are some of the drugs that are used for treatment of autoimmune diseases are there to block key factors that excite the immune system. And by blocking them, you dampen this immune response against your body's own cells. And actually, when you're talking to me about the sort of underlying causes, so one way that people do assess the factors important for these autoimmune diseases is that they could. So we know there are 25,000 genes, and you can rank them as to how important every single gene is for each of these different autoimmune diseases. And the one that comes out top is always the genes that is the real focus of my book, these particular immune system genes that I call the compatibility genes.
And so let's get on to those, because, you know, just it's worth explaining this, as you said, between 20 to 25,000 genes in the human body, and they code for, well everything, really. It just seems a quite a small number for the number of molecules that the immune system has to deal with. How many of those genes are directly related to the things that you're interested in, the immune system and the various compatibility?
It's certainly quite a large fraction of the human genome.
Several thousand is about your
defense against disease, yeah. Right? Defending yourself against disease is a pretty important part of what your body does. But the exact number, I'm not really sure. And even if I did know a number, I'm sure another scientist would say I got it wrong, because it's probably some ambiguity defining what an immune system gene is. But these particular part of the immune system that my book is really focused about is a few genes, a particular family of genes called what I call the compatibility genes. They have a longer name, the major histocompatibility complex genes, but we can just call them compatibility genes. And those genes, there are just a few in each of us. We each have a very different set of these particular genes. They're the genes that vary the most from one person to the next. So the big difference between me and you wouldn't be our hair color, right? Genes that control our hair color, eye color, or skin color, or anything else. It will be these immune system genes, the compatibility genes.
And what do they do? We've talked a little bit about immune system. So I imagine that, you know, if you get infected by a particular virus and I do, then, you know, we'd both create antibodies to that virus. And so that's a useful thing. But we're also sort of indicating that the immune system does more than just react to things coming into the environment around us. As you say, it's about compatibility. But what kind of compatibility are we talking about?
Okay. So these genes are, as I say, the genes that vary the most between individual people. So one way in which they're important is in transplantation. So And that's how they were first discovered. So one way in which they're important is they mark, in effect, your own cells to be different from my cells. And so you would have an immune reaction against the proteins encoded by those genes. So one way they're important is through transplantation. The next way that they're important is through allowing the immune system to work. So basically, they make a particular protein that is at the surface of nearly all your cells. And in effect, it looks like a sort of cupped, hand-shaped molecule. And within the sort of groove of that sort of clasped hand, if you like, would be a sample of what is being made inside a cell. So each cell has, say, 100,000 copies of this cup at its surface, grabbing something that's being made inside the cell. So in effect, these molecules are reporting on everything being made inside a cell. They're putting up at the surface of a cell stuff that's being made inside that cell. Then your white blood cells will check that stuff that's being made inside a cell. And if anything looks like it hasn't been in your body before, then your white blood cells will know there's something going on in that cell. And it will then either kill it or secrete stuff to tell other immune cells that we need to check this out more. So these molecules are reporting what is being made inside cells. The detail of how they do that is that, in fact, so these genes are different between you and me, like I say, and actually they have slightly different efficiencies of bringing things up to the cell surface. So let's take, so if there was one particular virus inside a cell, then perhaps the genes that you have will be really good at grabbing stuff made by that virus and putting it up at the surface of a cell. And maybe my genes would encode proteins that weren't so good at that.
This is after the virus has infected one of your cells, of course.
Exactly. So a virus has infected a cell, it started doing stuff, and now these proteins are grabbing bits of that stuff, putting it up at the surface to tell your white blood cells, look, there's a virus inside this cell. But we all vary in how efficiently we can do that for any particular virus. So one of the reasons why you might get, say, better from a particular flu virus in 2 days, but it might take me 4 days, one of the factors involved in that would be the particular versions of these genes that you have. So through that detailed understanding, that tells us that they're really important in our health and in the diseases we are resistant and susceptible to. For example, let me give you a really important example. If you're for people infected with HIV, about a very small fraction of people, about 1 in 300, don't develop AIDS for about 7 years. And so they're called the sort of HIV controllers. Their immune system is able to keep the virus in check. Why is that? What is it that gives them this special power that allows them to not get AIDS for a prolonged period of time? And it turns out that it's one of these genes that they've inherited. They have got a version of these genes that allows them to particularly efficiently detect the presence of HIV in their cells, and that's what allows them to keep that virus under control.
That's fascinating. Is that a potential therapy, an avenue for cures and things for that?
Well, you know, so all of this basic understanding certainly gives you it certainly gives you hope. In a sense, the fact that the immune system can keep HIV under control in some people certainly drives the passion of scientists that think that it's worth persevering with trying to develop a vaccine, for example. But we're not there yet, obviously.
So you talked about transplantation. You talked about the way the immune system actually works because of these compatibility genes. But it goes beyond that. This is reading the book, you get examples of whether people are attractive to each other or not because of this stuff. Now, how on earth do you get to that from those immune genetics?
Right. So that part comes from a sort of really wacky but fascinating experiment by a Swiss scientist. So what he did was take T-shirts worn by men for a couple of days and then have women smell them and rank them according to how sexy they felt those T-shirts smell. And it turned out that how nice they felt those T-shirts smell correlated with the versions of compatibility genes that the men had. In particular, they found the smell to be more sexy if the T-shirt was worn by someone that had different versions of these genes than themselves. So on the face of it, that is tremendously exciting. And what it suggests is that there's a sort of preference that these genes are working to influence our interpersonal relationships and our compatibility. But it's in fact very controversial.
But what, before we get to the controversial bit, why would you want to find someone with different compatibility genes attractive?
Okay, so the thinking behind that would be that it's very important that as a population, we keep that these genes are maintained with exceptional diversity to give us so if a virus would particularly affect me but not you, then it's the diversity in these genes that give us as a species the greatest chance of surviving disease. And each of us as individuals should have diverse sets of these genes between us for that to happen. So it's all about the system is set up to maintain this exceptional diversity amongst these genes within
people.
So you
unconsciously find attractive people who are genetically different to you in some way.
Right. So that would be the conclusion you would take from
that
experiment.
Though?
But as I say, it's very controversial. So in my book, I do detail all the different experiments that were done. And actually, I kind of sit on the fence. I want you to make your own mind up about it, although I give you all the evidence and all the arguments against it. It's certainly true that there's very good evidence for this happening in animals. So, for example, mice undoubtedly do choose their mates according to these genes that they have. And there's very clear experiments that demonstrate that. It's also true, for example, in fish. The mates that they choose relate to these particular genes. In people, it's very complicated. So at one level, there's this fascinating sort of basic biology about that is likely to be some aspect of us. The problem is that the way that we interact with people is very complicated, much more complicated than for mice, who basically just smell another mouse's urine and then decide. For us, it's not quite like that.
Might make things simpler if it was.
and so there's many aspects to, you know, so what creates a relationship between two people is much more complicated. So although it might be a part of us, it's hard to know how important it is. Let me give you a really specific example, going back to that experiment I mentioned, which makes it really clear. So if women ranked the smell of T-shirts, and I said that they preferred people that had different genes to themselves in these compatibility genes. But let's say the actual quantitative thing, the actual numbers they come up with. So let's say they rank T-shirts with a score of 5 out of 10 that they really like and a score of 4 out of 10 that they didn't like. So you can do, you know, careful statistical stuff and prove that was a clear result that's correct. What does that mean? You know, in everyday behavior, how important would it be if someone gives us, you know, ranks the smell of a T-shirt to be 5 rather than 4? Is that the big thing that's going to change anyone's relationship? Very, very hard to know.
So obviously human beings are more complex, as you said, than mice or fish. There are all sorts of other factors, including, you know, whether you like someone cognitively, you know, jobs, situation, locations, all these things.
Right.
But there's got to be something about this that is still quite important. Does it work at a population level? I mean, do you suspect that if you were to sort of sequence these genes in a million people,
yeah,
you would see some sort of effect where people are quite different in their...
So the people have looked at these kinds of things a bit, and again, it's controversial. And the controversy there is that it's hard to know because people tend to form long-lasting relationships in particular social contexts. Although, I mean, London's obviously very cosmopolitan, but still, so for example, analysis was done in San Francisco, and still, you know, people would tend to form their relationships with people of similar ethnicity or similar groups that they are geographically located with. And then that then clouds the issue as to whether or not these genes are important, because already there's a particular version of these genes correlate with your geographical ancestry. So that makes it complicated to analyze, to answer your important question.
What is it that scientists like you want to know about this stuff then? I mean, it sounds like an interesting academic exercise and a really fascinating biological sort of question, I suppose. But what is it that this is going to answer for you for the next generation of understanding what immunology is all about?
Firstly, I think there's the wonder of it that's really powerful. So in a sense, you know, you like something like Darwinian evolution doesn't change my life tomorrow. But still, thinking about it every so often gets me excited. And I think it's the same thing, right? So that it's that. It's the wonder of it. It's like, so this is part of who and what you are. An unexpectedly large amount of your identity, even, the thing that makes you different from me, that has come from how our species have evolved to survive disease. So I think first and foremost, it's the wonder of it that gets me excited and passionate enough to come and tell you about it today. There are, for example, there's good evidence that these genes can influence, for example, the likelihood that a couple may or may not have certain kinds of problems in pregnancy. So going forward, that may give you clues to how to deal with some of these problems in pregnancy. And in the longer term, clearly medicine will embrace our genetic differences. And it's nothing, you know, it will lead to ethical dilemmas for sure, but it's nothing that we need to shy away from. And understanding that is important. And I think it's very important that that's a general public discussion so that we're ready for moving into that era of a more personalized medicine.
So we're talking about like gene therapy and stem cell technology where you're changing your genetics or you're developing cell-based therapies which will have immune responses in the body. So you need to understand those immune responses.
So that as well. But what I'm really thinking of is that, like the way we discussed, that these genes will make you and I respond differently to a particular virus. So if that's true, then it's not a stretch to think that you and I would also respond differently to a given medicine. So I'm thinking about the idea that medicines will be given to people according to the genes that they have. And that is extremely likely to happen in the near future. And it's very important that that everyone is aware of where that comes from and that we're not scared of that kind of approach to medicine.
That's been the hope since the Genome Project was announced back in 2003, hasn't it?
So that is true, that obviously all of these things take much longer than anybody imagined. But there are some examples where that is already the case. For example, there's a particular drug against HIV where the side effects are severe if you have a particular version of one of these compatibility genes, and so checking for that would mean you could avoid people that would react very badly to that drug. So there are examples of that. But the sort of big message for society that comes from all of that, which all of this analysis, is this: there's no hierarchy in these genes. Nobody has the perfect set of these genes. The whole system is set up so that we are exceptionally diverse in these genes. And for me, that is one of the best messages that biology has forever for society.
Diversity is the way forward for this, basically.
Right. That everything is about maintaining our exceptional diversity. Nobody has better or worse genes. There's absolutely no hierarchy.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The Compatibility Gene is published by Alan Lane, and it's out now. We'll have links for more information on the book and Daniel on the blog for this podcast. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for the latest science news day or night, go to theguardian.com/science, where you'll find a fantastic animation all about Stephen Hawking's big ideas. And while you're there, do check out our string of other videos under the banner of the Newton Channel.
In fact, Japan now has similar issues to the UK when it comes to encouraging students to study science.
That was a focus on science teaching in Japan, and it's the latest in that particular series. But for now, many thanks for listening. It's goodbye from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps. See you next time.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 20% off by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.